Welcome to Conversations on WDRT 91.9 from Viroqua, Wisconsin. With our guests today, we're going to be discussing local efforts to protect dark skies from light pollution, and specifically, we'll be discussing a program called the Kickapoo Valley Dark Skies Initiative. My name is Sarah Bratnober, and I was invited to interview our guests today here on WDRT. In full disclosure, I am a collaborator in this initiative through my employer, Mississippi Valley Conservancy, who is one of the partners in the program we'll be sharing. I am joined today by Scott Lind, board chair of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and electrical engineer with a pro bono dark sky lighting consulting service called Redshift Electric. And I'm joined by John Haisley of Driftless Stargazing, which is a very popular Facebook page that helps a lot of people to enjoy and appreciate our night skies here in the Driftless. So I'm going to ask each of you to share a little bit more about yourselves and your affiliation with this project and your role in all of it. Scott, do you want to start?
Yeah, good morning, Sarah. I've been a professional licensed engineer in Wisconsin for about 35 years. I also hold a master electrician's license in Wisconsin, but I've been passionate about dark sky lighting for 25 years now. I'm really the technical resource for the volunteer group that's involved in this initiative. That's what I serve as.
Great. And John, how about you? What's your role in all of this and more about your background and affiliation here?
Well, I've been volunteering with Kickapoo Valley Reserve the last 12 years as an instructor, where I've just learned an awful lot about environmental education. And then, as you mentioned, for about the last 10 years, I have been an astronomy educator with Driftless Stargazing, where I do a lot to try to connect people with the cosmos. And I also volunteer with an organization called Dark Sky International, and I'm an advocate with them, doing what I can to conserve starry skies for this generation and future generations.
Thank you. John, tell us about how and why this Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative got started, and who's involved?
Well, this is a partnership among Wildcat Mountain State Park and Kickapoo Valley Reserve and Mississippi Valley Conservancy, who conserves the Tunnelville area. And it was picked this because this area just has extraordinary starry skies that people have been enjoying for a long time. I know I've been sharing stargazing at Wildcat for over 20 years, and it's long a destination for other stargazers. And I've been sharing astronomy programs at Kickapoo Valley Reserve going back to 2013. And this idea of having it designated as a special dark sky park has long been part of the master plans. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on this project with Scott and Marla Lind, and also with Susan Cushing as well.
Excellent. And, so you mentioned a little bit about why these partners were identified as the right partners. Can you talk just a little bit more about that?
Yeah, because they do have these very starry skies and have this very long history of cooperating on the conservation of 13,000 acres of land that's publicly accessible along Kickapoo River here in Vernon County.
Yes, and that land is almost contiguous, too. It's like adjacent land in the river, so it's quite a beautiful stretch.
It sure is, Sarah.
John, tell us about what are the primary goals of this Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative.
Well, there's a number of goals, and what really fits in with the mission of the three cooperating entities is protecting this very valuable and unique ecosystem along the Kickapoo River, the wildlife there, and they very much depend on darkness for safety and navigation. They have been for hundreds of millions of years enjoying the night sky, and now we're losing that. We also know we've got insect and bird populations on the decline for a number of reasons in the last few generations, but light pollution is a known cause of confusion among these species that's reducing their populations. There's other benefits as well. It's about conserving energy and reducing costs, especially reducing carbon dioxide emissions that are causing so much global warming and climate change. And it's a rewarding project to work on because it's kind of easy to address this issue of light pollution. Sometimes you just need to turn a light off, adjust it, change a light bulb. And then I guess one more reason is this idea of enjoying the night skies for the physical, mental, and cultural benefits about spending time outdoors and learning about our place in the cosmos. That we humans have been stargazers for a long time, observing night skies, enjoying them all around the world. And I'm also mindful that we're on the land of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and members of the Ho-Chunk Nation have long lived here and continue to live here, learning about the cycles of night and passing on that valuable information. It's something we share with friends and family and people around the world. And I guess if we need one more reason, there's economic benefits as well. We're a destination for something called astrotourism. People need places where they can see starry skies and where they can be reminded that night is good for humans and other living things.
Thank you. I agree. We'll spend more of this interview talking about each of those areas. So this is a good overview. John, I'm sure a lot of people think that skies in our part of rural Wisconsin are already pretty dark. Is light pollution really a growing problem in our rural part of the state? And how do we know it's getting worse?
You are right. We already get to enjoy very dark and starry skies that, you know, people who live in the area can regularly see the Milky Way. And most people living in the United States can't do that anymore. And I guess it's also good to be mindful of that listeners may be less familiar with this concept of light pollution. Sky watchers have known about it for, you know, over a generation now, but I know other people might not be as familiar with light pollution as we are with water and ground and air pollution. But it's just light in places where it doesn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
We had thought for a long time it was increasing at 2% a year, and in the last year, you know, more studies have shown that it's actually increasing at 10% a year, and we're losing the night, and that has a lot of repercussions. How do we know this? Well, my mom told me. My mom's in her 80s now, and she said, you know, Johnny, we see fewer stars than we used to. And I hear the experience of other sky watchers.
Mm-hmm.
We can measure it scientifically through ground-based observations. There's a great citizen science project called Globe at Night. You just go outside and count stars and report back to how many you're seeing. And then we also have satellites in low Earth orbit that can look down and measure how much light we're putting up into the sky.
Mm-hmm. I know you're the one who's been taking measurements of our dark skies here in the Kickapoo River Valley. How do you do that?
Well, I go out to Wildcat and KVR and Tunnelville late at night when the skies are clear and there's no moonlight. And I've got about a half dozen locations there, and I just travel there with my light meter, and I hold the light meter up to the sky and just record how bright and how dark the sky is. And then in addition to the light meter, I just observe with my eyes and see, you know, how many stars I can see. Can I see the Little Dipper? Can I make out the Andromeda galaxy? Can I see the Triangulum galaxy? How much structure do I see in the Milky Way? And those are a little bit more subjective, but it's part of measuring how the dark sky is. And then we can also look at satellite observations that are looking down at Earth and measuring how much the sky is brightening.
Mm-hmm. I know you have shared a light pollution map that is really quite detailed. You can see right down to your business or your community where there is a lot of light spilling out. And I wondered if you could share where that map can be seen.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, that map is put together by researchers at UW-Madison, so I'm glad they're taking the lead on that. And we've put together a good website about the Dark Sky Initiative project. And so on our webpage, we include that light pollution map. And you can also go there and just see how much the light pollution has been spreading over recent years.
Mm-hmm. And that's on the Kickapoo Valley Reserve website, right?
Yep. I would just Google Kickapoo Valley Reserve, dark sky, mm-hmm. and that will come up. Or if you're on the main page, just look for the dark sky page.
Great. You know, speaking of maps, I just want to chime in and mention a couple other maps that kind of underscore the need for what's here that needs to be protected. There's something called the Kickapoo Wildcat Important Bird Area, which is designated by, I forget if it's Audubon or Cornell, but it shares the exact same footprint on the map. No surprise. I mean, it's these protected lands in the Kickapoo Valley. And there's a whole team of agencies working to protect habitat for birds in that area, including 13 species that are considered to be rare. Well, those are birds that depend on darkness, as so many of them do, for migration in particular, but some of them also for hunting and other activities. I've also seen a map recently by the Nature Conservancy that illustrates Wisconsin's biodiversity, and it clearly shows the driftless areas having a high level of biodiversity, more than many other parts of Wisconsin. So there's a lot here to protect. There's a lot at risk. And then I've also been seeing recent bird migration maps that underscore the need for reducing light pollution right now, as millions of birds are on their way back to our area during their current spring migration. So, you know, if you don't get around to changing your light fixtures this week, what you can do is turn off your lights at night and really just eliminate any non-essential outdoor lighting for these next few weeks while the spring migration is going on. So I bring up these maps just because they show so much is at stake. And we'll talk about some solutions next. So we've touched on the importance of protecting dark skies in our area, and we can talk about that more. But I want to be sure we also discuss the causes of light pollution and the practical solutions and things that we can all do to protect much-needed dark skies. You know, the great thing is that the technology is available, and in some case, it really just takes awareness and some planning to make necessary changes. You know, sometimes it might be as simple as changing light bulbs. So, Scott, tell us more about what's behind this rapid increase in light pollution.
I think one of the key things that most people have in their heads as kind of a myth is that more light is better. And it's really not true that more light is necessarily better, and we can talk about that in a lot of detail. But part of the problem is that because LEDs, as they came into use, are so much more efficient than the previous light sources, because you have this idea in your head that more light is better, now more light is cheaper. And so as a result, people put up more light than they used to because it doesn't cost very much to do that. So that's one of the big, big problems.
Is there something about LEDs that, they just give you more light, so you just go for it and have all this.
Well, they don't necessarily just give you more light, but it's the fact is that for any given number of watts, if you put up 10 watts of an older source, say, you know, metal halide, for example, or fluorescent, right, mm-hmm. compared to 10 watts of LED, they're much more efficient. So you get more light out for the same amount of energy you put in. And so when you see things advertised, you know, this is only using 10 watts, that's fantastic, but I'm getting, you know, twice as much light as I was getting before. It sounds good to people, right? Mm. That's kind of the problem with that is it sounds good to have more light and it's cheaper. One of the other big problems is that, you know, wall-mounted lights, which is really what a lot of us deal with. Most of us don't have parking lots on our property, you know. Wall-mounted lights traditionally had a front lens on them, a clear lens or a Fresnel lens, it's called sometimes, to spread the light out. And that's because the way the light was distributed before was all done with reflectors that had to be bent and folded to direct the light in a certain direction, right? And that was very expensive and very complex to do that. And so because traditional lights had those lenses on, most LED fixtures were just modeled off of those. But the fact is that with new LED fixtures, you can direct the light much easier than you could with just bending up folded metal before, and so you don't need the exposed lens. So we can get around the problem. But because most of them are built that way now, that light gets scattered around like it used to as well.
So are we mainly talking about commercial light fixtures here, or are we talking about the lights that I might want to put on my garage?
We're talking kind of all the above,
okay.
Really. I mean, there's no outdoor light that doesn't contribute in some way to light pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to hesitate to tell people that it's just a commercial problem or just a large parking lot problem. Any fixture that's out there can be, you know, designed and improved to make it less impactful in terms of all these things we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The other big factor is that many of the cheapest fixtures that are sold are not that full cutoff design. They still have that exposed lens we talked about, and they're only available in, I should give you some definitions, but in higher color temperatures. So LED fixtures are kind of new in terms of the ability to change the color of the light. In the past, those sources, the color of the light was fixed. There was no change in it. And now with LEDs, you can tune those LEDs by adding phosphors to change the color temperature. In some cases, that's good. Some cases it's bad. But many of the cheapest fixtures out there are only available at higher color temperatures, lots and lots of blue content. So that's part of the problem as well. And I think that's a fact that most people don't understand the negative impacts of blue light at night on humans and on wildlife. But that's starting to change. But as of right now, that knowledge isn't very widely disseminated. So that's part of the problem as well.
Interesting. So is it because blue light rays or light particles travel further than red light? Is that why?
It's that they scatter more.
Scatter more.
They scatter more.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And they scatter, the more blue light you add, the more they scatter. And the amount of scatter is not a linear relationship to the amount of light. It's logarithmic, right? And so if you add a little bit more blue light, that scatters that much more.
So what are the most common sources of light pollution? I've heard you use the term glare bomb. What is that?
Glare bomb is, for the most part, a wall-mounted fixture that's too bright, usually too blue, and it's not full cutoff. So if you drive around anywhere in town, in the countryside, and you see a bright light shining at your eyes, that's what I would call a glare bomb.
And I know we can talk more about definitions, but one I do hear a lot is this description of a light being full cutoff. What does that mean?
So full cutoff means if down towards the ground is 0 degrees, pointing straight down is 0 degrees,
mm-hmm.
and horizontally is 90 degrees,
mm-hmm.
a full cutoff light emits no light above 90 degrees, zero light above 90 degrees.
So it's being cut off by some kind of shield or structure.
That's
that right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I see.
Mm-hmm. There's an opaque top, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that top makes sure that no light can go up, and it also limits the amount of light that's emitted between 80 and 90 degrees above. So that's full cutoff.
Well, great. We're going to talk more about solutions, but this was a great introduction. First, we're just going to have a quick station break. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. I am your host, Sarah Bratnober, and the name of our show is Conversations. My guests are Scott Lind of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Management Board and John Hesley of Driftless Stargazing. We're talking about how and why of protecting dark skies in southwest Wisconsin. And you can listen again or share this show with a friend on the WDRT website archives. Those are at www.wdrt.org/archive. So, Scott, is this something that individual homeowners and landowners can help with in addition to towns and cities?
It really absolutely is. I mean, a lot of this problematic lighting is on private land. So we know we're going to have streetlights, and we can definitely, you know, pick the right streetlights in cities. But all the private property owners, homeowners, business owners, et cetera, have a part to play by picking the right fixtures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting when you look at that night sky map, you can see specific farms and properties that have a lot of lighting. So if you're wondering if you're showing up as a light polluter, check out that map. And I'm just going to ask you for a few more lighting solutions, and maybe we can talk more about where people can potentially get products. We talked about full cutoff. I know a couple of other terms that I've heard you mention are bug, which is short for backlight, uplight, glare. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a rating that applies to light fixtures to tell you how much light is going behind the fixture, how much light is going up into the sky, and how much glare comes off of that fixture. So
I see.
It's a good way to look at a light fixture if it has a bug rating on it without having to turn it on and get a sense of what it's going to look like. And the key thing there, the most important thing there from the dark sky perspective, is to make sure that the U value, the U part of bug, is zero. You should never buy a fixture that's got a bug rating of anything higher than zero.
You know what I did? I bought these kind of can lights for my front of my house to light the sidewalk, but they have a light bulb pointing down and another light bulb in a can lighting up. And I don't need to light the sky. I just wanted to light the sidewalk and the front steps. So I just don't have light bulbs in the top half.
That's a super simple solution.
Yeah, and right. Some people might have light fixtures like that. You can literally modify what you have.
Right.
I mean, there are some really neat new products available, and we'll talk more about those. But I think it's a good place for people to just start by looking at what they have and thinking about if there are easy modifications they might be able to make, like light bulbs for a start.
You're exactly right. Yep. If you've purchased LED light bulbs for your outdoor fixtures in the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, go look at those bulbs and see what the color temperature is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a number that's going to be 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000, followed by a K.
Yeah.
That's the color of the light. If you see anything higher than 3,000, go find another light bulb. Put a light bulb in that's 3,000 Kelvin or 2,700 Kelvin. Pick one of those two temperatures and replace that light bulb. That's a great way to start.
Interesting. Great to know. What else can we do in addition to improving our lighting at home? Should we be contacting our city council or our county board? I mean, because obviously, you know, as a homeowner, I think, well, these two light bulbs, how big a difference is that going to make? But, you know, then when you drive down Main Street, it's obvious, or you even drive, you know, out past town where there are businesses and manufacturing plants, you're seeing a lot of light. How can we influence these people and inform them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the problem is accelerating, really. That's what John alluded to earlier, that it used to be increasing at, say, 2% a year. Now it's increasing at 10% a year. So the problem is getting worse faster all the time. And because LED sources last so long, they can last up to 15 years.
Wow.
Right? So we really need to consider adopting outdoor lighting ordinances to get ahead of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is a win-win proposition. I mean, we aren't putting a burden on people by doing this. It's more about pausing and thinking about providing the information they need to make the right decisions, because it really has the opportunity to enhance their security, their safety, there's energy savings to be had, plus all the other benefits that there are that we've talked about for wildlife and other things.
Mm-hmm. So, and what about things like farms and manufacturing facilities? I suppose if we know people that own businesses, we should just share this information with them and ask them to think about being part of the solution.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, all outdoor lighting contributes to the problem, but the more fixtures they are and the higher output fixtures, they have more impact, no doubt about that. So parking lots, buildings that have multiple wall lights that are burning at full brightness all night, they're definitely key issues that need to be addressed. So, yeah, that's exactly right. If you have a business, you know, look at your own business, or if you patronize businesses and you see problems with their lighting, it'd be fantastic to approach them and explain this kind of issue to them.
Yeah, I know. I saw in one of your presentations how the light from a big store on a main thoroughfare was actually not only lighting their front of their building and their huge parking lot, but also even lighting the houses across the street. I mean, they're just, the lighting is just flooding so much further than probably what's really needed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's a case where the example you're giving, I was able to talk to the business owner, and they recognized the problem once it was pointed out to them. They hadn't thought about it, or they weren't there at night, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. And they were able to make changes that were able to improve that lighting situation for the houses across the street. So,
yeah, not to mention all the birds and insects that are confused by what is going on.
Exactly.
So I know you and our partners at Wildcat Mountain State Park have made changes in lighting at your facilities. And since the beginning of this whole Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative, can you share some success stories from that and tell us more about some changes that have been made?
We looked at about 60 fixtures that existed, and we really used 5 principles when we looked at those fixtures to make changes.
Are you referring to at Kickapoo Valley Reserve?
I'm referring to the combination of Kickapoo Valley Reserve and Wildcat Mountain State Park.
Got it.
Tunnelville Cliffs was easy because there are no light fixtures.
I know, we're lucky. And there never will be.
And there never will be. That's a fantastic thing for a natural area like that. That's perfect. So there's some things we did. We removed some fixtures that we determined weren't useful, but that weren't needed, right? That's the simplest thing, right? Zero energy cost, right? That's the ideal thing to do. Other fixtures, we added shielding, or we replaced some lights so that the light was more targeted to the areas where we actually needed it instead of scattering it everywhere. We reduced the light output to the amount that was needed. That's another principle that we applied there, either by changing the lamps and or adding dimmers. We did some of each of those things. We also changed the bulbs on all the fixtures we kept to be lower color temperatures. Most of them, the numbers I mentioned earlier, 2,700 Kelvin, which is great. Some of them at 3,000 Kelvin, just because some things weren't available at 2,700 Kelvin. And then we added timers and motion sensors to lights to give us more control options. And those really address kind of the 5 principles.
Great. One other thing that I think is wonderful about that is that working with Wildcat Mountain State Park, I mean, imagine getting a state agency to change the way they're doing things. Well, one of our partners in this project is Andy Hafley from Wildcat Mountain State Park. And I think he's even influencing the rest of the state park system with some of the changes they've made.
Yeah, that's the goal, is to be able to educate, broadly.
Right.
We're very lucky now in that new state projects, not just parks, but new state projects now, the specifications and the design guidelines for engineers that are designing those projects actually require full cutoff fixtures. And they require those designers to use the dark sky principles for new installations. So going forward, brand new installations, right, that are designed by engineers, architects, will have those principles included. But we've got a huge stockpile right now of existing structure, right, with lights on them. And this is an opportunity to show those existing agencies and parks, et cetera, how it can be done, how it can be improved.
So are you saying those design standards are the standards of the state park system, or the more of a statewide or national standard?
Statewide.
Oh, wow.
So projects that are designed for the state of Wisconsin. So it doesn't apply to private entities, but state-owned facilities that are designed now are required to have full cutoff fixtures, and the designers are told to use the dark sky principles in their lighting designs.
But for existing projects, there's not a requirement to change them.
That's correct.
So we have to do a little bit of back work.
That's correct. And that's the thing about it, is that, the vast majority of those fixtures right now are probably still high-intensity discharge. Sorry to throw out another technical term, but they're probably not LEDs. Mm-hmm. Many, many have been changed already. And the ones that have been changed, say, 5 years ago are probably bad because they're probably too blue. Maybe not full cutoff, but there's still a lot of them out there that could be changed. So the goal would be that when they're going to be changed anyway, you're going to be changing them anyway, let's buy a dark sky fixture.
Fantastic. I know you've also been working with some nearby communities in the Kickapoo Valley and had some success in that regard. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Village of Ontario has really engaged with us in this effort. Alina Energy owns and operates streetlights in a lot of communities, including Ontario, and the village agreed to have them use a lower color temperature streetlight than Alliance standard number. So, you know, if you drive through Ontario now and look at the brand new streetlights that were installed 2 years ago, those are 3,000 Kelvin color temperature streetlights. So they're a warmer color temperature. And when those streetlights were replaced by Alliant, because they went to a full cutoff light fixture, they reduced the light output from those streetlights by 50%. They're 50% of what they were before in terms of gross light output. But the light on the street is exactly the same as was before, because the rest of that light used to be wasted to the sky, and not true anymore. So you could really have that extra level of energy savings in Ontario, and they really are really working with us on this, not only the streetlights, but also other public buildings.
Wow. So they must be saving energy, too. They're not just helping the birds and the bats. They're also saving on their electric bills.
Yeah, and you know, Alliant Energy is doing going to full cutoff fixtures, even though they're using higher color temperature in many places. They're going to full cutoff fixtures, not because, you know, of an environmental reason, although I'm sure they're, you know, that's a side benefit, but they're motivated by the fact they can save so much energy.
That is great. And they are a state or national company?
Utility. They cover Wisconsin and Iowa primarily.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned five principles of effective lighting. Maybe we could just run down that list and talk a little bit more about those, because we are in this kind of practical section of our discussion where we're talking about solutions. Could you just run down that list with us again?
Sure. The first one is useful, and that's really the easiest one. So before you install a fixture, think about why you're installing it. What purpose is it serving? Or if you have an existing fixture and you're thinking, do I really need that fixture anymore? That's useful. That's the first principle. It's the easiest one, right? You don't need to think much about it. Just, is it needed? The second principle is targeted. So once you've decided that you need a light fixture for some purpose, make sure that you're targeting that light in the area you need it, not just kind of putting up a fixture that lights everything, but actually goes to the area you're trying to light. That's the second principle, targeted. The third principle is how much you use, the amount needed. And that's measured in lumens. So if you go buy a light fixture or go buy a light bulb, it's going to have a number in it, so many lumens. So don't think about it in terms of watts. That's part of the problem we get into with LED fixtures, is the watts are generally lower than we're used to, but the lumens is the number you want, how much light do you need. Because it doesn't take very much light in many, many places. So that's the third principle. The fourth one is about color temperature, what color the light is. You want to make those 2,700 Kelvin or 3,000 Kelvin. Keep them warm, not blue, not cold looking, right? And the last principle is controlled. So not just a photo eye that turns it on at sunset and turns it off in dawn, but timers that could shut it off in the middle of the night when you don't need it, or better yet, motion sensors that only turn it on when there's something there that needs to be lit. And consider adding dimming controls so that you can turn the amount of light down and have adjustability on those fixtures.
Yeah, you know, when we were talking about color temperature, reminded me of something we've all experienced with cars. In new recent years, have these incredibly bright, blinding headlights that drive a lot of us crazy. Is that because of the lumens and the warmth, or the blue lighting of those?
It's a combination of those two things, right? So it's a combination of the fact that they are very bright, right? The number of lumens coming out of those headlights is very, very high. And the second factor is that those, typically those headlights are at 5,500 degrees Kelvin, very, very blue. And blue light inherently scatters more. So it's a combination of those two factors is why we're seeing that problem.
Yeah, so if we imagine the confusion or kind of fear that we fear, that we feel when we're driving down the road and someone is blasting at us with extremely bright light, I mean, that's what wildlife might be experiencing with all that we're throwing up into the sky with our lights.
Right, especially for fixtures that are on all night long.
Right.
It's not just a passing car.
Right.
Right.
So going back to useful, I think that's a big subject for discussion, because some people seem to feel the need to light everything. And I guess that's where the question of usefulness comes in. And maybe that's where timers and light sensors, motion sensors come in?
They can. I mean, it's, you know, the usefulness of light can also be time dependent, right? So there are places, in fact, the energy codes now require businesses to install controls that after they're closed or after midnight, for example, and before 6 a.m. or before they open, those lights dim to 30% of their value. And that's because it's known that they aren't as useful in the middle of the night. In fact, I could make the case they aren't useful at all.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been many, many studies talking about light in terms of security, for example.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, if I keep everything brightly lit, there won't be any prowlers around on my property.
Right. I heard one person recently refer to them as insecurity lights, which I thought was a perfect phrase. John liked that one too, I know, didn't you, John?
I sure did, Scott.
And that's, you know, there have been many, many studies done looking at crime, especially crimes like vandalism and graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that, you know, there are many humans who are afraid of the dark, right? It appears that criminals are exactly the same because studies found that there was more vandalism and more graffiti in areas that were lit as opposed to unlit areas. They need light to be able to see what they're going to do, right? So there's many arguments to be made that adding that light is not going to increase your security and may, in fact, decrease it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Usefulness. Well, I'm sure people are wondering where they can find these fixtures and light bulbs and controls. Is there a resource or even a place locally where we could get a start with some appropriate light bulbs and fixtures, or maybe some online resources?
Yeah, I think, you know, ideally we would go to our local hardware store.
Right.
That'd be the first choice, shop locally, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, many of the local hardware stores, like every other entity that sells light fixtures, is still carrying primarily fixtures that are not full cutoff, right? But I would encourage you to go anyway, and now that we've shared with you some of these principles to apply, full cutoff and warmer, et cetera, go in and ask for those things.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to create a demand for those things locally.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't find them locally, the darksky.org website, Dark Sky International has a website called darksky.org,
mm-hmm.
and they have a section on there for choosing light fixtures.
Yes.
And they have an approval stamp. You know, it's Dark Sky approved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a place to start as well. With this initiative we have, we've just started a Facebook page recently, Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative on Facebook, and I've started to create what I call Tech Tip Tuesday, and we're going to try and make it as easy as possible for people to pick the right fixture, to buy the right lights. You can also look there as well.
That is great. I know we collaborated on putting that Facebook page together because we're three nonprofit organizations that don't have time to be replicating all this information on our own websites. So we created a resource that will be that is available now on Facebook. It's called Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative, and you know, people can begin getting information and advice right now, and we're going to continue to use that as a kind of a hub for information about the causes and solutions and benefits of all of this work to prevent light pollution.
The other thing I'll mention, Sarah, and at the risk of having an avalanche of responses, is I do have this pro bono consulting service.
Yes.
That I started a couple of years ago because I'm essentially retired now, but I do have a lot of experience and I'm happy to share it to achieve this goal. So if people go to redshiftelectric@gmail.com, you can send me an email at that email address, redshiftelectric@gmail.com, and I'm happy to engage with you as much as possible to give you specific advice for your situation. If I can, I'll come out and look at your situation. I'm not going to install the light fixtures for you. I don't have that kind of time, but I'm happy to give you advice on what to purchase.
That's fantastic. And that, you know, that would be a good contact to share with our, like, our city council or businesses that might want to learn more. So that's fantastic. Also, if anyone wants to see one of your first of all, I've noticed you're on the calendar a lot lately, and you're making presentations all over the place so people can learn about this, which is fantastic. But if you'd like to see one of Scott's presentations, you could go on YouTube and search for Kickapoo Valley Reserve Driftless Dialogue. And there's a great recording there of one of his recent presentations that goes into a little more depth about all of the things we're discussing today. So we're going to take a quick station break. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Sarah Bratnober, and the name of our show is Conversations. My guests are Scott Lind of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Management Board and John Hesley from Driftless Stargazing. We're talking about the how and why of protecting dark skies in southwest Wisconsin. You can listen again or share this show with a friend on the WDRT website archives. That's at www.wdrt.org/archive. Well, I loved hearing about the work that you did to help the town of Ontario improve their lighting. I hope they're saving money, I'm sure the wildlife are appreciating it. Scott, tell us just a little bit more about how, you know, have you gotten feedback from that project, and what was that like?
Yeah, we definitely have. I mean, it was interesting when I first talked to the village board about this concept of using warmer lights for the full cutoff street lights. Again, I think it was just not knowing what that meant, and there was some concern. There's one of the board members has some eyesight issues and does a lot of walking and was concerned about how these lights would affect their ability to do that. And then after it was all done, they said, oh, this is no problem. In fact, the reduction in glare helps, right? Mm-hmm. So I think had very positive feedback. I mean, Mark Smith said it best. He was the former village president, and he said, you know, you can get by with less lighting. Just put it where it belongs instead of putting it up into the sky.
Perfect.
Yeah, I couldn't say it any better myself, right? And as a result, the village board now, because of the flooding in Ontario in 2018, the village board has purchased, I believe it's 40 acres of land, kind of southwest of the village, and that's being developed right now as we speak. The grading's going in and so forth. Because of the efforts that have already been undertaken, they've included in that development agreement there that anything that goes into that area will have to be dark sky lighting. So any new businesses that go in there or anything else gets developed, and there will be dark sky lighting. It'll be 3,000 Kelvin and full cutoff fixtures. I've also talked with another developer in the village who's currently building an apartment building. Had great conversations with them, and you know, again, not being aware of the issue, but as soon as they were made aware, they wanted to do the right thing, and so they're looking at putting dark sky fixtures in that structure as well.
Fantastic. Ontario is a poster child for dark sky lighting. Who knew? and thanks to you and your consultation for helping them to get there. I know I just read about some work that you did with the Vernon County Parks. Can you tell us about that, and how are you helping them, and how are they helping with this issue?
Yeah, that really was a big collaboration. I had a very small part in it by recommending a fixture to use, but Dave Cryer and the Friends of Vernon County Parks was really instrumental. He and Bill Brook went out to the Sophia Park, mm-hmm, and took measurements of the existing light fixtures out there and wanted to know if we could do something to put full cutoff fixtures in. And so I recommended a fixture, and they've been installed now. They were just installed this past few days.
Wow.
And so now those fixtures are full cutoff. They're 3,000 Kelvin in color temperature. The lighting on the ground is better, and the glare is gone. And that really is a model that could be repeated over and over and over again in other parks, especially where you've got a bathroom building in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want some light there to let people find the bathroom, but you don't want the light shining out everywhere else and affecting wildlife.
Fantastic. Gosh, it's so great that these examples are happening right here locally so people can check them out and see that it's perfectly effective lighting. It's just much more thought through in terms of what's useful, what's targeted.
Exactly
right. How much
right.
do you really need?
Exactly right. Yep.
Fantastic. You know, we're talking about the how and why here preventing light pollution, and I want to be sure we talk a little bit more about why. And we started with that at the beginning of this show, talking about wildlife and health and economics. And I just thought maybe we could review some of those things. You know, we've talked, and John, we'd love for you to chime in on these too. So there are kind of five big benefit areas that we can talk about. There's wildlife and ecosystems. I'm going to just chime in on this one because I just read the other day on the Dark Sky website that 70% of mammals and over half of all insects are considered to be nocturnal, and that while most birds are mostly active during the day here in North America, 70% of bird species migrate, and of those, 80% migrate at night. So right there, you know, we've all been learning about how our bird populations are in decline, and certainly this light pollution is part of the problem. So again, 80% of our migrating birds are traveling right now. So let's start thinking about improving our lighting. But meanwhile, right now, tonight, and for the next few weeks, you can turn off more of your outdoor lights and help those birds. But again, with habitat loss being a leading factor in the extinction of thousands of endangered species, we really need to bring awareness to the role of artificial light and what it does that's you know, partially causing this devastation. But it's a hopeful situation because the solutions are relatively simple. There's human health is another key area. Is that mainly about just our kind of our what are the circadian rhythms and being able to sleep at night and that kind of thing? And I guess climate change is part of it too.
Yeah, and I'm not a biologist, so I hesitate to address that. But yeah, the research shows that blue light at night especially, you know, too much light in general, but blue light at night especially has a lot of negative effects on human health.
That's why we're not supposed to be looking at our computers before we go to bed.
Exactly. It's exactly the same principle just applied to outdoor lighting, but it's the same exact thing.
Mm-hmm. And another key thing we should be thinking about is energy and climate change. That's certainly affecting our health, or has the potential to. So people are potentially saving, you know, we're preventing excessive fossil fuel emissions when we cut back our electric use.
Yeah, that's something I mentioned over and over again, is the fact that, you know, going to LEDs is going to save you energy. Going to full cutoff fixtures can save you 50% more on top of that already. Wow. And so regardless of whether you're generating the electricity with coal, or like we've got solar panels in our backyard, right? So that's solar power energy. Regardless of what the source is, if you can reduce the energy use by 50%, that's a benefit regardless of the source.
Exactly. And that's better for the climate, and that goes back to everyone's health, both ours and the wildlife.
And your pocketbook.
Exactly. And we talked about crime and safety and how it's very much debatable as to whether more light really makes you safer and more secure.
Yeah, there's an image that I use in my presentations that shows a bright light on a garage, mm-hmm. and the person in the house looking out towards the garage to a gate beyond the garage. And with that bright light unshielded, you cannot see a person standing at the gate. And once you shield that fixture, they appear to you. And that's because of contrast, right? Uniformity is really important. You don't necessarily need to be completely uniform, but if you have too much contrast and too much glare, it hides the things that you're worried about being able to see. So that directly addresses the concerns about security.
Mm-hmm. And then there's, I love this, the idea of night sky heritage. And John, you touched on this earlier, and the fact that, you know, it's not just those of us that discovered stargazing in the last 20 years, but I mean, it's as long as humankind has been on this planet, there's a heritage of our understanding and use of the dark skies.
Absolutely right. I couldn't agree more that we humans have been sky watchers for thousands of generations. It's our thing. And in just the last couple of generations, it's something that we are losing. And I would ask people to consider, shouldn't that just be the birthright of every child born today, that ability to look up and to see a sky full of stars and to see thousands of stars instead of hundreds of stars or dozens of stars? It's very sad to think about that kids born today, by the time they reach adulthood, they're going to have fewer stars that they can see to be wishing upon. And I'm glad that we've got this Kickapoo Valley Dark Sky Initiative to keep people connected with the cosmos. We've got this vision of stars streaming above and this Kickapoo River flowing below.
Yes.
And connecting those two things together. And so we want to preserve it for this generation and future generations. This is our home, and we love it here in the Driftless area, here in Vernon County. It's here we can see the rest of our home. We get to see the solar system. We get to see the Milky Way and the rest of the cosmos. It's where we live. I think everybody should have that ability to experience awe in the natural world. I'm just 3 days away from returning home from seeing a total eclipse of the sun, which is one of the more moving experiences of my life. And we need those experiences of awe to look up, to see the Milky Way, to see a sky full of stars, to see meteor showers. And I know the benefits of that. It just fills us with a sense of vastness. It fills us with gratitude. It fills us with generosity. It takes us out of the ordinary. I want everybody to have those opportunities to experience awe. And I'd like to leave everybody with this sense of hope. Yeah, we keep talking about light pollution, and it's discouraging of that it's growing at 10% a year. And I know we've got so many environmental problems right now calling for our attention. But I know that environmental problems like climate change and groundwater contamination, they're tough ones to solve. They're expensive. There's winners and losers. We've got this saying that you can solve light pollution at the speed of light. There's very simple steps we can take for the benefit of wildlife, ecosystems, and the humans as well.
Thanks, John. And I love the idea that you're measuring what's happening out there with the night skies. And, you know, ultimately, maybe if we all work on this as a community, we can get back to the darkness of the skies that we had 3 years ago. I mean, it's very measurable and doable. And maybe we can be a poster child, too. So,
yeah, it absolutely is doable. Yep.
Yep. And I love that Vernon County and that whole area is a poster child of this. This can happen.
So, you know, I think that I just want to remind everyone that to enjoy the night skies that John's talking about, anyone can visit the websites of Kickapoo Valley Reserve, Wildcat Mountain State Park, or Mississippi Valley Conservancy. And those are easy to Google if you don't have their addresses. But they all have maps for where their stargazing is, where they recommend it. At Mississippi Valley Conservancy, you just need to find the map for Tunnelville Cliffs, which is the nature preserve right there. And you'll see on that map where you can stargaze. And KVR and Wildcat have the same things on their websites. You can find out just where are the very best places to go and view the night sky. So I hope everyone enjoys that, and that is one of the great benefits and one of the incentives to protect what we have. I wondered if we could maybe begin to wrap up here. Scott, you have a really wonderful quote that I heard you read from Ed Yong's book, and I wondered if you could tell us about that and share that.
Sure. That's a book called An Immense World, and Ed Yong's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and this book is really about how different animals sense the world compared to humans. And in his chapter in the book discussing the impact of artificial light on wildlife, he says, "We too quickly forget we don't perceive the world in the same way as other species, and consequently we ignore the impacts that we shouldn't. We normalize the abnormal and accept the unacceptable. Remember that more than 80% of people live under light-polluted skies. Many people have no idea what true darkness or quiet feels like. Within that experience, vicious cycles start to spin. As we desecrate sensory environments, we become accustomed to the results. And as we push animals away, we get used to their absence. As the problem of sensory pollution grows, our willingness to address it subsides. How do we solve a problem that we don't realize exists? And I think that really goes to the point of, it's not about people who are trying to do the wrong thing, they just need to know how to do the right thing.
Right, right. And you know, so many people come here to hunt and fish and be a part of nature. They could also help to spread the word and adopt some of these relatively easy solutions.
Exactly, right. It really can spread statewide and nationwide, and there are efforts ongoing many, many places to do similar things.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining me today and sharing helpful information about how and why we can and should protect our beautiful night skies here in the Driftless area. And we want to thank WDRT for giving us this opportunity to share information with the larger community. Thank you.